Each year, an average of 260,000 tons of oil spill into North American waters. Worldwide, it's almost 1.3 million tons each year. Yet, it's only in the wake of a catastrophic disaster like the Deepwater Horizon oil spill that we begin to investigate what caused these spills. In the second of today's underreported segments, we're going to look at the oil spills both around the world and in the United States that have gone largely unnoticed by the mainstream press. And joining us now are Richard Steiner, professor of marine conservation at the University of Alaska, and Dr. Eric Gundlach, founder of ETEC International, Incorporated, an oil spill consulting firm. Welcome to our show.
Great to be here. This is Eric.
Hi, and great to be here as well. This is Rick.
Rick, in the wake of the Deepwater Horizon spill, many news outlets have started looking for other spills, and it seems for the first time they've started reporting on some pretty horrible conditions, such as the spills in the Niger Delta. Are those reports accurate?
Certainly. Most of the reports are based on work that myself and colleagues have done there in the Niger Delta over the last 4 or 5 years. And the numbers are rough estimates, certainly, but an effort we did in 2006 with the Nigerian government, a number of scientists in the Delta, and NGOs took all the data that we had, and the data is rough, certainly, and derived an estimate of about 200,000 barrels spilled per year over the 50-year period of oil development in the Delta. So,
well, that's that's the equivalent of an Exxon Valdez spill each year?
That's approximately correct. And then
wow.
I refined the estimates 2 years after that for in another project, and they are on the order of at least 100,000 barrels per year on average, up to 200,000 barrels per year, and some years more, some years less. But on average, and the actual number might not be critically important, but the magnitude of the problem is what's important. And the fact that it's been out of sight, out of mind to the U.S. consumer and to the U.S. government is quite unfortunate.
Eric?
I would like to add something about the Niger Delta as well. It's not only accidental spillage, because, of course, the oil companies like to keep the oil in the pipeline because that's where their money is. They don't like to have spills. But there are many, many acts of sabotage for personal gain and for the village gains in the area as well. So that has to be taken into account as well as the accidental discharges.
Well, industry negligence of the sort that is being claimed in the BP spill?
Well, I'm saying I agree that in industry, negligence has to be proved yet. However, in the Niger Delta, there are very many specific cases of sabotage on the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just add to that as well. There are indeed cases of sabotage in the Niger Delta. Nobody refutes that. However, there are a lot of cases where there is not sabotage and not illegal bunkering going on, but just simply poorly maintained and operated facilities and aging pipelines and just wanton negligence going on by the transnational companies as well as their Nigerian government partner in these operations. So, there is sabotage and there's also malfeasance on the companies.
What about cleanup procedures? Are they taking place in the Niger Delta?
They're atrocious. They're horrible. They often don't get to a spill site for days, if not weeks, after reporting. Oftentimes, they'll simply walk away, and they'll claim that there's – and sometimes there is a violent threat when they come to try to respond to a spill. That is real in some places, not always. But I've been to spills that were ongoing there for months at a time with no response effort whatsoever. And it's a complicated dynamic in the Niger Delta, certainly, where sometimes, as your other guest mentioned, people will blow up a pipeline or a facility to cause a spill, to get the company there, to seek compensation. That does happen. But also, a lot of times, that is not what's going on. It's just spills that occur from poorly maintained pipelines, and then the company comes and they said, well, this is sabotage, and they do what they can, and then they walk away and they don't pay anybody. And so that creates more enmity and anxiety amongst the people.
Eric, are there any other oil spills of this magnitude that have happened in the past decade or so that we might have missed?
I would just add one more thing to the Niger River Delta. There was a large pipeline spill. It was a Chevron facility offshore, and as you know, as a good corporate citizen, they hired the people to clean it up, and it was Clean Nigeria Associates, and there was a fairly good response to it, and there were compensation claims and payments made. So you know, maybe it it varies on the magnitude and the company. There's all sorts of variables to that. About other large spills, I think we have to look at some of the large oil spills in the Arabian Gulf. Number one, caused by Saddam Hussein, who, you know, opened up the spigots in Kuwait and the oil drifted south as what's called the mother of oil spills. And there was another Nowruz blowout in the Arabian Gulf as well. Very, very large spills.
And then aren't there other kinds of spills? For example, I've been hearing about spills in the Amazon with indigenous people suing the oil companies, in some cases American oil companies, in some cases Argentinian, for environmental damage. These are kind of like slow oozing spills. Do you know about them?
You may be talking about the Ecuador case, possibly in the jungle area.
There's and just recently I heard of a Peruvian case against the Argentinian National Oil Company. They're claiming that they don't have the money to clean it up, but then they are taking people's land and using it for helicopter ports and things like that. It's just a recently developing story. But it seems to me every time I hear another one of these stories, for example, the one that we've reported on a lot on this show, the oil spill in Greenpoint that has gone pretty much ignored for 50 years or so. That's Greenpoint, Brooklyn.
Exactly. I'm aware of that, yeah.
These things have been happening a lot. It's only something as dramatic as the BP spill or the Exxon Valdez spill that gets any attention. Why do you think that is?
Well, absolutely right. I remember going back at we have an oil spill conference, an international oil spill conference. It used to be every 2 years, and now it's every three. But it rotates internationally as well. But right before the Exxon Valdez, the representative from API said essentially, this is in 1989, that all the oil spill problems are essentially solved and there is very little need for this meeting anymore. And a month and a half later, the Exxon Valdez happens and everything changes. The world changes with new legislation and controls, and the same thing's happening here. I believe it's a series of complacency. Everybody gets used to the norm, and in this case, it was deep water drilling without really testing the blowout preventer valves and making sure that it's safe.
The both of you have had experience working in Lebanon to clean up after spills there. What was that like?
Well, my experience was during the 2006 spill. And it was when the Israeli Defense Force struck the tank farm south of Beirut at the GA power station. And then a pretty substantial spill occurred in the eastern Mediterranean, flowed straight north across the Lebanese coast and even Syria and splatters further north even. The response there was complicated because a couple of things. Certainly, the responsible party was a hostile neighbor, Israel, and so you had no BP or Exxon to come in and try to respond. And then, secondly, the response was trying to be conducted during a war. At least the first part of it, and that was very difficult as well. But you know, they got some of the beaches cleaned up. It was a mess. It was a difficult one to respond to, but there was a lot of international assistance in that one. But you know, the bottom line here, and I'd like to hear your guests comment on Lebanon as well. But as long as we're using oil, we're going to continue to spill it. People will make mistakes. Equipment will fail. We have to insist that it be produced and transported as safely as possible. And that's where we're not quite there, obviously, with deep water drilling and Arctic drilling. And you know, the one thing we fixed out of Exxon Valdez was tanker safety. And so tankers are far safer now than they were 21 years ago. And even the world community, the IMO, International Maritime Organization, followed suit with the U.S. law that we passed in 1990, the Oil Pollution Act. And that's a good thing. But we didn't, you know, get the bigger message that we needed to move to sustainable energy as quickly as possible and stop having to be so dependent on oil. So,
although I'm assuming that now deep water drilling will have all sorts of new safety standards put in place.
Yeah, but if that's all we get out of Deepwater Horizon, we will have really lost the big lesson, I think. So,
Eric, you wanted to add to that?
Oh, well, I agree entirely. You know, safety and security are the main issues. We want to get back to a little bit more about Lebanon, because I think I was there after Dr. Steiner met some of the same folks that he was working with. It's correct. The first month, it's a very interesting spill, because the first month there was a war going on and there was no cleanup. So it really only got started at a very, very small localized level with some very good Lebanese green groups, one in particular doing some active cleaning and getting the oil off the bottom. And then I would also like to add the USAID program threw in over $1 million to get a U.S. firm with some local counterparts cleaning some of the important sites as well.
Aren't there some spills in countries that aren't always internationally cooperative, like Angola and Iran, where it's impossible to assess the damage?
Yes, of course, but most of these days, because of the international funding for compensation, they usually let in groups, particularly out of the London insurers. For instance, Cuba used to be very closed, but they would let in people to help assess and develop compensation schemes for it.
First of all, I should tell everyone who my guests are. I'm speaking with Richard Steiner, professor of marine conservation, University of Alaska, and Dr. Eric Gunlock, founder of ETEC International Incorporated, which is an oil spill consulting firm. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. And Rick, I guess you don't go along with the government of your state, Alaska, when you say that we should find alternate means of fuel, the governor and the previous governor have, and senators have been saying something quite different there. How much of
Sure.
this is a political issue?
Yeah, and Alaska is, 90% of our state budget comes from oil revenues, and so we have all the fallout and sort of other implications of all that. So all the politics in Alaska sort of swirl around oil, and they're generally very supportive of oil development anywhere. And lacks government oversight and regulation. I mean, the state of Alaska was a contributing factor to the Exxon Valdez disaster, quite frankly, and so was the federal government. It wasn't just Exxon or Alyeska. It was the lax government oversight that sort of was one of the causal factors, as it was in the Deepwater Horizon, as it often is, certainly in the Niger Delta and some of these developing countries. They simply don't have the technical capability nor the financial resources applied to conduct adequate oversight of oil and gas, and so therefore you have these problems crop up. So,
well, what happens with liability? Because right in the case of the BP spill, the United States has insisted that BP pay for all of the cleanup, but we've seen all sorts of denials in other situations. I didn't do it, or it's some company that was owned by other people that we just bought many years later that did all of this terrible stuff. Is it possible to establish liability in many of these spills?
Absolutely. I mean, and this one is a simple liability case, but also that, they are required by federal law to be liable for all cleanup and response costs, as well as in this $75 million cap. But the cap goes away if there's gross negligence proven, and there's been so many lines of evidence pointing towards that I don't think that's going to be an issue. Plus, BP just agreed to establish this $20 billion victims compensation fund. That's an unprecedented step, and that's and I applaud them for that. What I would what I have also proposed to BP as well is to establish a corollary $20 billion environmental restoration fund, because certainly the people deserve prompt attention and their economic losses, but that's all the victims' compensation fund will cover is economic losses for private claimants. Nothing whatsoever to do with environmental recovery, and I think it that deserves an equal footing here as well.
Well, what happened in the Ishtok 1 spill that happened in the Gulf of Mexico in the past that this spill is being compared with?
Well, the spill, the blowout took on the order of 9 months to control. Fortunately for the United States, I worked on Ishtok a long time ago in the, along the Texas coast, and only during a short period, about a month, month and a half, did the oil actually reach the shoreline of Texas. So most of the impacts were either offshore or along the Mexican coast. And then through a fortunate set of circumstances on the order of September 6th was an early storm, what they call northers, which blow the wind from the north, which changes the current patterns, and the oil was 90-something percent removed from the Texas shoreline by natural processes.
But who was responsible for any cleanup there? Didn't the Mexican government say that they weren't legally required to pay for damages that occurred in Texas?
Exactly. In those days, it was what I would call the very early stages of oil spill and oil spill response and compensation. And our cleanup recommendations, as a matter of fact, were only to do it in the localized high tourist areas, in the parks, very small areas, because it had covered on the order of 100-plus miles of shoreline with tar balls, and the Texas shoreline in that case is very erosional. So if you start sending workers out that remove 10 times as much sand as one tar ball, all of a sudden you lose substantial amounts of shoreline.
Eric, your website is filled with pictures of oil spills that happened in the United States over the past 30 years, many of which I hadn't read about or read very little about, such as the New Carissa oil spill off the coast of Oregon, the Swanson Creek oil spill in Alaska, the North Cape oil spill in Rhode Island, which killed over 9 million lobsters, 19 million clams, and 4.2 million fish. Why do you think those spills have gone relatively unnoticed?
It's in the papers for a while, and then, of course, it goes down to the order. Once the oil is gone, once it's off the shoreline, everybody goes away. And then it's a matter of the damage assessment and the legal and the liabilities, and it's in the newspaper every couple of months. But for the most part, they disappear when the oil disappears.
We have a slideshow of some of those oil spills on our website at WNYC.org and a link to your website. Rick, you worked on an oil spill off the coast of England that happened to coincide with hurricane-force winds, which emulsified the oil and pushed it out to sea. Was there really no lasting damage in that case?
That's apparently the case. It was the Brer, an oil tanker fully loaded, traveling from Norway towards the States. It lost power in a storm and drifted ashore on South Shetland. I think this was 93 or 92 or something, 90, somewhere in that period. And it, of course, broke up and lost the entire load of oil, twice the official volume estimate of Exxon Valdez. But it was followed by about 3 weeks of the most intense hurricane-force winds. And I live in Alaska, and I'm used to this, but this was an intense sequence of storms in Shetland with, you know, 100-plus knot winds for several weeks. And so it churned up the upper sea surface down to probably 100 meters, maybe even 200 meters deep. A lot of sediment got churned up into the water column. The oil adhered to the sediment and emulsified, and it basically, once the storm subsided, it's apparently settled out into two sedimentary basins on the seabed in the North Sea. Some of it did. They found about maybe a third to a half of it there later on. So as far as shoreline oiling and surface impacts, it was dramatically reduced by this extreme intense turbulence for the several weeks post-spill. So this brings us back to the Gulf of Mexico, and I guess when the first hurricane rolls through there this summer, we can expect several things. One is the oil that's in the water will emulsify more heavily due to the turbulence of the wind and wave mixing. There will be sediment churned up. near shore that will adhere to whatever oil is in the water column. And after the storm passes, it will settle into the seabed, so there'll be a vector of contamination there. Plus, whatever oil is within the water that will travel with the storm surge. And so areas inshore in the marshes and possibly even considerably further north could possibly be oiled with the wrong scenario of a hurricane with oil in the water there.
So we can do all of the cleanup we want, but nature winds up playing a major role in either exacerbating or aiding in the cleanup?
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. Storm waves turn this into a giant mixer or a blender, and all of a sudden you're creating a whole series of smaller particles and enabling the bacteria to really go at those small particles of oil and do what nature does and getting rid of the oil that's normally and naturally entering the marine environment.
We have very little time left, but I wonder, are oil spills that occur on land via pipelines and such easier to clean up than the oil spills that wash ashore?
Oh, much easier. You just get out there with some workers or a backhoe and remove the upper sediments and take it to an appropriate dump area.
Absolutely, yeah. Eric, he's absolutely correct there. If it's in a water body, it will travel wherever the water is flowing, particularly a river or a coastal current or something like that. That's a nightmare scenario. If it's on land, it might percolate down depending on the substrate type and such, but it's basically stable. It's going to be there. So,
thank you both so much for contributing to today's underreported look at the uncovered oil spills, Richard Steiner and Eric Gundlach. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thanks very much.